Mother Earth News is brought to you by Bookshop Santa Cruz, where you can obtain all the issues of Mother Earth News magazine. Bookshop Santa Cruz, where browsing is a way of life, is located on the Pacific Garden Mall in downtown Santa Cruz. Time now for Dialogue Conspiracy on KLRB-FM, brought to you every Monday evening at 5:15. And your host, Mae Brussel.
This is Dialogue Conspiracy, a perspective of events which directly affect world affairs. Your host, research specialist Mae Brussel.
It's been a long time coming.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy, and another week rolls around very fast. It does for me. I don't know about you, but it seems where Mondays come around quickly. I want to announce a magazine. I just got a issue of it. Paul Krasner mailed me that my listeners might be interested in subscribing to. It's called Counter Spy, and it's a bulletin of called the Committee for Action Research of the Intelligence Committee Community, and it's a magazine that sells for $6 a year, the subscription, and it breaks down the different spy organizations are going to try to do in this country and in foreign countries that our government finances and arranges so that people can understand the spy community better. They're going to answer all kinds of questions about the Watergate and questions whether the FBI is becoming a secret police force, and it's going into every method of spy operation that's utilized by our government. The address is P.O. Box 647. It's C-A-R-I-C, P.O. Box 647, Ben Franklin Station, Washington, D.C., 20044. It's really a great magazine. The first issue is on the Operation Phoenix, the assassination program that took place in Vietnam, and it's very pertinent. I think I mentioned last week or the week before that William Colby, the new acting head of the CIA, was one of the top men in charge of the Phoenix program. And the Phoenix program practiced the most brutal forms of assassination and torture that the American government had ever devised or utilized or that we knew about. And Ambassador Colby had lied concerning the Phoenix program and its cost and the number of the victims and the amount of funds that were used. And he is now the acting director of the CIA. It is an affront to people to have this man in the United States directing a part of our government the way that he's been placed. He took the place of Mr. Schlesinger just recently, and I think that letters to members of the Congress and Senate against the appointment of William Colby would certainly be appropriate. This book goes into the origins of the Phoenix program, which had to do with death. It has to do with different kinds of torture that we used in Vietnam and other countries. We have schools of torture in South America, the CIA has. It goes into the methods of rape, electrical shock, water tortures, hanging from the ceiling, beatings, incarcerations, executions, and then the famous airborne sessions where they take three men up to helicopters and drop one out and try to get the other two to talk. And the book is just filled with information of the whole program, who the director was. When you break down the names, it's important to study the names, because at the time of Watergate now, when the Senate committee asked for information from the Pentagon pertaining to certain documents, they go to a man who was a member of the Phoenix program, who was into assassinations and espionage of a very diabolical nature, and I'm sure that he's not going to release information on these particular operatives that are being arrested in Washington right now. They all work together on various operations with the same methods. And the names are familiar running through the Watergate now and the Phoenix operation that took place in Vietnam. And the magazine is an excellent magazine. It's CARIC, C-A-R-I-C, P.O. Box 647, Ben Franklin Station, Washington, D.C. The subscription is $6 a year, and then they said it's $75 for agencies of the government. I thought that was funny. They charged me $86 for the Warren Commission hearings, and but that's okay. That was 26 volumes. Well, the Watergate hearings take place again tomorrow. There was 1 week recess while Washington got a hold of itself, I think, from some of the shock that was going on, revealed the first 2 weeks of the hearings. There were some quotations as the week rolled along. We heard John Dean say that the whole thing is still coming out inch by inch. There's one more mile to go, and he says we have a long way to go. The administration hopes that somehow they wouldn't have to travel that full mile with Prosecutor Cox. It looks like they would go another quarter inch. We'll have to watch what he's going to do, but the forces are moving on, and I think we'll even, no matter what he does, he'll look as ridiculous as the original men that prosecuted, so I hope the trial keeps going on. James McCord, you know, the week before last of the hearings, had information that involved top men of the government, and if they blamed the CIA for the Watergate affair, he said every tree in the forest will fall. If the White House tries to put the blame for Watergate on the CIA, and the prestigious committee didn't ask what he knew, it would take one tree away, much less the whole forest. The White House was accused of Hitler's tactics. James McCord had said that he felt the White House was taking over the CIA for political purposes, identical to Hitler's intelligence agencies in the 1930s. Bernard Fensterwald, the attorney for James McCord, has said that the country wants to know the truth about the Watergate, and if having the truth brought out the means implicating the president or some of his staff, so be it. Penn Jones Jr. from Texas had written in a book, Forgive My Grief. The head man was in Dallas, and in that book he talks about Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover being at the home of Mr. Murchison on November the 21st, 1963. I mentioned this, I'm wondering if these are some of the trees in the forest, and I've referred to it on other programs where the killing of President Kennedy was the most important takeover of the country in world history. All the major forces in the country were involved and had to be accounted for at that final conference. Richard Nixon, November 21st, in Dallas, Texas, with J. Edgar Hoover. Louis Tackwood, agent provocateur in Los Angeles, says in his new book, Coming Out the Glass House Tapes, that Martin was the code name for his contact for the overthrow of the government, the Martial Law Plan. His Squad 19 is the Operation Intercept, the group in Washington, that secret police force that is contained in John Dean's files. Mr. Martin was in Dallas, according to Louis Tackwood. He says, Martin was CIA all the way. Now, that is the name Martin, Edward Martin, that James McCord signed in at the police station when he was arrested at the Watergate Hotel, James Martin. Louis Tackwood said, Martin is CIA all the way. He was in Dallas when they got Kennedy. He left out of there for the Caribbean. Martin was in on the cancellation of the election and the concentration camp thing. They would kill Nixon and Agnew would walk in. I bring this up to wonder if these aren't some of the forests and some of the mentality that was taking place in Washington, because Senator Sam Ervin said that the secret papers of former White House aide John Dean reveal a Gestapo mentality in the highest levels of the Nixon administration, and it would be a shock to the American people if the contents of the papers were ever made public. He said it involved an interagency operation to spy on Americans, especially those who disagreed with the administration. And Joseph Alsop this week said, it's dreadful to think in America about the Nuremberg trial, but it's time to think about the trials because the plea of the Nazi leaders made vainly at Nuremberg. They said they were free of guilt for all they had done, but they were servants of the German state. They were obeying the orders of Hitler. This is all relevant to the Watergate case. If you heard the hearings the week before last, this week they were off, of Mr. Caulfield or Mr. Lasowitz, Bernard Barker, James McCord, they could break laws that they knew were laws of the land if they had orders from above. And it's time to think of the Nuremberg trial. When I studied the assassination of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and people would say, what would you do in the event that you were right and the truth came out? And I said, you have to think of a Nuremberg trial. If ever the truth unfolds, it's like the invasion of Europe and the taking back of Germany from Hitler, and Alsop this week was writing about the Nuremberg trials. Well, there's a lot of investigations going on around the country, and if you don't keep a cross-filing system like I have it, you tend to lose track of what's happening. There's grand juries right now, one in New York going into campaign funding and business fraud. That's John Mitchell, the Vesco Corporation that brings in Donald Nixon. He was transporting or a part of a conduit of funds. He hasn't been named yet, but the perjury trial of Stans and Mitchell takes place pretty soon this week or the next week. The grand juries are in New York, Houston, Texas, Orlando, Florida, and Los Angeles. Now, each one of these is as explosive as the Watergate Hotel. The Houston, Texas involves the laundering of campaign money. In Mexico, the first one in New York is two cabinet members, Marie Stans and John Mitchell, two cabinet members and a Security Exchange Commission legal problem and the Nixon campaign money. The one in Houston, Texas is the laundering of campaign money. That one was so important alone that the White House asked the Central Intelligence Agency to stop the FBI from going into the sources of that money. They said it would interfere with other operations going back to 1961. Well, I'm going a little later on the program, I'm going to talk about Mexico being important in this whole scene. But Mexico is where Oswald spent time, Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. Sirhan Sirhan had connections into Mexico. James Ray spent time in Mexico. The assassins are paid from conduits of money washed in Mexico. The alleged assassins are the School for Assassins, the Marksman is in Mexico, in Ahuaco, Mexico. There's dummy fronts covering up American money because the plans come out of Washington, but it's sent down to this other country and put into different banks and channels to lose its traces. The Mexican money, the campaign money that was found in Bernard Barker's bank, was raised by John Conley and Robert Mardian, the former assistant attorney general in Washington who stepped out to raise money for the campaign for Richard Nixon last March or so. And John Conley's Houston Foundation, CIA foundations, are in Houston, Texas. The Mexican money came out of Houston, Texas. Lewis Tackwood said the plan to overthrow the government, the martial law plan, and the small elite group of police force, the private police force from the White House, worked with Houston, Texas. So there's many, many reasons why the White House found it necessary to ask the CIA to stop the FBI from questioning the Mexican money. I could give you a whole show on just Mexican money. Grand jury investigation to go back in New York, the Vesco. Houston, the Mexican money. In Orlando, Florida, it's campaign sabotage and dirty tricks. Well, Orlando, Florida is filled with grand jury investigations because four of the men arrested at the Watergate were not only involved in the Watergate thing, but they were up at the demonstrations at the time of J. Edgar Hoover's funeral. They were in New York City. They might possibly have been in the Cuban embassy. They're checking that out. They were out in California, the files of Daniel Ellsberg, the psychiatric files. These agents were called their private army, called by Howard Hunt. As Mr. Barker testified, when Eduardo comes, I call. So this grand jury investigation of these men is going on. It involved forged letters and a series of charges. They hired hippies to urinate and defecate on the street. That came out this week at the time of the Democratic convention so that the news media would pick it up and show what kind of people voted for McGovern. These were registered Republicans that were hired to, as I say, to dress like hippies, defecate and urinate on the street, given our CIA consecutive $100 bills by Republican police agents and Central Intelligence agents to discredit George McGovern. This is all going down in Florida. Then the Los Angeles grand jury case is so big that Mr. Cox, the federal prosecutor, tried to call that one off. That's bigger than the Watergate, and if you can give them a grading of A, B, C, and D, they're all A cases, because this is going into the problem of blaming the burglary on a man who was already in jail, and then it necessarily involves the Beverly Hills Police Department working with the Central Intelligence Agency, because I know from my research the police departments pay people and promise those in jail to get off early on parole, pay people to send innocent people to jail, and they closed the case. The Beverly Hills police, not having a suspect, could have left the case open. But then somebody may have snooped around and traced who was in the Ellsberg office. This way the case was closed, and a man already in Folsom was charged with that. The Ellsberg grand jury case is going to be very big. It's explosive. Now, the Senate investigation, those are the grand juries, the New York, the Houston, Florida, and Los Angeles burglary. The Senate investigations, there's three major ones, the Intelligence Operations Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee. This goes into the involvement of CIA and FBI into domestic affairs. There's the Armed Services Committee on CIA in domestic affairs. The Foreign Relations Committee calling back Richard Helms on confirmation hearing disavowals, where he claimed when he was sent as ambassador over to Iran, he is asked to testify before he went, and it seems that some of the things he said were, I don't know whether you call it perjury, how that holds up, but there were inconsistencies in what he said before he left this country, and he's been brought back. So there's four Senate investigations. There's a Senate committee, Sam Ervin, on the campaign practices. And then in the House of Representatives, there's a special subcommittee on the CIA of the Armed Services Committee, continuing the CIA involvement in the United States, and the General Accounting Office, irregularities in collection and the use of campaign funds, which goes into all the private safes, the 1968 money, the provocateurs hired, the illegal stashing away, and that opens up a hornet's nest. So we find ourselves this week with the Watergate on major 12 explosive investigations going, but these are the major ones. There's an article in the New York Times that compared the Oval Office to the corporate tactics that are used whenever a large corporation gets caught in a swindle or a deal. They have a set of tactics, mainly five. One is dismiss the problem as irrelevant, which is what the third-rate burglary attempt was supposed to be. The second is discredit or harass the critic, and that's the way the White House goes after the Washington Post and the New York Times. The third is send the rabbits to guard the lettuce patch, which is what the Justice Department and the Central Intelligence Agency have been doing ever since the arrest of the Watergate. The fourth thing to fall back on is national security is at stake, and that's being exploded right and left. We don't even have to talk about that. If you read your morning papers or evening, Jill Crow's excuse that it was national security to go into the Ellsberg office, and there's a lot more excuses, the Pentagon Papers. It turns out that Congress, members of Congress, had the Pentagon Papers in 1969, and Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo begged the congressional committees to read these to see what was happening in Vietnam, and Congress ignored all this, so they took it to the press, and then all of a sudden Richard Nixon got excited because it was in the hands of the press. Another way is to agree to a consent degree. That means when everything else comes out and you have nowhere to go, you admit that something is wrong, but that you're not guilty, that you promise those acts won't occur again. You have a consent. You will not let them happen again, but you're not guilty of what you did. And that is a public relations job that allows you to keep going and cover up instead of biding time for trials, I suppose. The White House team said, we're only obeying orders all the way up, and then when they get to the top, the president wasn't supposed to know what happened, so you wonder who was giving the orders. Ronald Reagan is too much for me to keep up with. I swear, there's no way to keep up with that man. He's the last vestige of the total police state that we ever. He's the going strong as a candidate for the president to inherit Richard Nixon or Spiro Agnew's mess. And Ronald Reagan is too much because you have to study where he was at the time the men were arrested at the Watergate, what his aspirations were in presidency, where he fit into the police state, who supports Ronald Reagan, like Henry Salvatore, Patrick Frawley, and the same people, Herbert Kalmbach, the Lincoln Club, the same secret espionage group, the far right wing that supports Ronald Reagan for president of the United States. Supported Kalmbach and these secret spy groups that were sabotaging the Democratic Party. And after 1972 elections, we would be in a total police state. So you have to take the frame of reference of what I'm talking about in terms of if the Watergate hadn't taken place, because the Office of Management Budget had already taken away legal aid for the poor and scientific research and so forth. And Ronald Reagan, Neville Young, and Mr. California, the two law and order team funded by the same crooks that fund the same people that fund those crooks in Washington, had three methods of control for the police state that still can come in, but it's a real fight to stop them. They had three ways of controlling things in the state of California, and then I suppose move it on to the national level, after the elections in 1973, because the president intended to escalate the war, which showed that anti-war protests embarrassing the president would be taking place and all critics would have to be rounded up, and the minorities were going to be forced out on the streets to fight again as job opportunities and racism surfaced overtly. And they had three methods of control that Ronald Reagan presented. The first one was in January of this year. The second came back in March, and the third was also in March, and now this week he presented his fourth control. The first thing he wanted was an institute to study the causes of violent behavior down at UCLA. And I have gone to the hearings in Sacramento and talked about that. It's a problem. This group is funded by the Criminal Justice Department in Washington, the same conspirators that were in with John Mitchell, Dean, Liddy, the same Justice Department, Martin, and that group, are funding this particular school that will do medical cures for minorities, social controls. It's not a social study of violent behavior. It's a medical thing of actually curing. And they would use prisoners, alter brains, and they psychosurgery they rule out, but they have every kind of drug for altering and silencing radical political prisoners. The Institute of Violent Behavior has been a thing that I've been working hard since January to spread the word around. The second thing they pushed very hard on the ballot was the death penalty in November. The death penalty is important because, as I repeat, in almost every show, the innocent radicals that are in prison, the minority people, and they would silence many of their political passes that I study as part of conspiracies. The next thing that Reagan and Younger have been pushing is the Office of Emergency Service, and we did a show on that. It's a two-way radio control that James McCord was working on to, 1984, the two-way speak system into the home, and from everybody's television radio set, on the guise that they would save us from tidal waves and earthquakes. It's exactly like 1984, and I thought that the Roseville, the ammunition thing that blew up was a test case for the OEO, and the Alameda airplane crash a while back, OES rather, and the Office of Emergency Service is a very dangerous cover for a police state that was to come to effect. Now this week, Ronald Reagan came up with his fourth control. He had evidently all these packages since January 73, and he pulled one a month. He just about wears me out, but it takes me a month to write letters and get to public officials. The latest under, again, his public relations guise is public safety. Now everyone's out for public safety. But the public safety cabinet is what will it be? What it's supposed to be is a new cabinet that he devised called a safety task force. That sounds okay so far. A safety task force. What would it take? It would take from the State Department of Health and Welfare Agency, combined all different agencies, including Highway Patrol, the military, this is the military, the Office of Emergency Service, the California Council on Criminal Justice, the Crime Technology Research Foundation, and the penal system for California, the prisoners. It would take all of them under one umbrella. And he's going to propose this to the Assembly. I wish people would begin writing letters now, because the UCLA Institute has been a standoff. And a few people have worked hard. This is outrageous. You see, when he wanted the UCLA Institute to study and cure violent behavior through all these medical techniques, a lot of people objected, and they went to the Department of Health and Welfare in the hearings, like up at Sacramento. But if all these decisions are taken out of every department in Sacramento so that only the military decides on the penal system and on the justice system and the crime labs, if there's no control, It is a real Gestapo to handle all radicals, all prisoners. There'd be no way that we could break into that system to really liberate any political prisoners at all. Any techniques they wanted to use, any methods of control, any investigations they'd do, they could clear any political patsies, they could lock up the innocent. It's the most diabolical thing to come up. I thought the institute at UCLA was bad, the death penalty was bad, the Office of Emergency Service. And now this week, Ronald Reagan has come out, and the Chronicle refers to it as a state super agency where the police combine with the military and the penal system. The penal system is becoming interesting to the outside community, people like myself trying to turn people on to these prisoners. Anthony Russo and Angela Davis are working on this now. The outside is becoming involved. There's about 20 new books out. If you read the book sections of the Sunday papers or magazines on the prisons, the terrible problem in American prisons and tortures and harassments and lockups, indeterminate sentences. So when the outside world begins to catch on, they say, well, we'll take the prison thing away from the Sacramento desks and we'll put it under the control of the military. So it's very, very dangerous, and I think we have to begin writing letters about that. One of the things the police department uses a justification for these drugs being used and for tighter control, that they've often asked, well, don't you think that poverty or lack of education contributes to crime? what are these links to crime? So Los Angeles Police Department just last week had quoted a crime study, and this report said the study doubts the link between crime and poverty. And the study was done in New York City. I'm going to give you the name of the study the LA Police Department quoted. The Council on Municipal Performance, a newly formed nonprofit research organization funded by private foundations and based in New York City. Now you see, that's a CIA front. No college professors, no one from the community at large showing any correlation between crime and poverty. None of the rich children of San Quentin or Soledad or Folsom or Vacaville, none of the tests are being done to the children, you know, families that are well off or middle class. This is all minority testing. None of them got the syphilis test, the test on babies that was done in Texas recently. These are all minorities that are so poor and no money for lawyers, and they're kept in prison. And the important thing is that they make their own report out of a CIA dummy front in New York City and then quote that as being the authority on the relationship between crime and the police. Well, talk about police investigations. I had a little conversation this afternoon before I came to KLRB with a Mr. Shields, Sergeant Shields. He heard that on KGO I talked about the killing of Robert Crown. Robert Crown was a member of the Assembly up in Sacramento on the Judiciary Committee who held the deciding vote on the death penalty, which affects these political passes. I'm talking about an innocent man. And Crown was run over when he was jogging. And we talked about on last week's show. When I spoke on Roy Elwell's show on KGO, I mentioned this as being a possible political assassination. So I received a phone call from Sergeant Shields. It reminded me of a call I made to LA Police Department at the time that Sirhan Sirhan was accused of killing Robert Kennedy. Sergeant Shields told me he was the investigator for the death of Assemblyman Crown, and he heard me that on the radio I said it was a possible conspiracy. What evidence did I have? So I went into my background and my research, my reason for watching the pushing of death penalty at this time, who was doing it, the things I talked about, Evel Young and Ronald Reagan, their desire to reinstate the death penalty. So I said to him, let me have a little information about the man, because this was a deciding vote, let me have a little information. Tell me about him. What is the name of the man who ran over him? Tell me his name. And the investigator, this is the chief investigator for the murder of Robert Crown. He's been working on the case 1 week, would you believe, 1 week, and he's the chief investigator. I said, well, what is the name? Let me get the information straight. What is the name of the man who ran over Robert Crown? He said, well, I don't have his first name here. I don't know it. He's been working on this 1 week, but he doesn't know the man's name. Can you imagine how many interviews he's had? So I said, tell me, where does he live? He says, he lives in a row house. I said, well, in a row of houses, or what kind of a house? Is he new in the community? How long has he lived in the community? because I've studied what I call migratory birds that come. Some people come in, do a job, and leave. He says, no, it's sort of a condominium, a row of houses. I said, can you tell me where he works? Because I had in mind, is he military? Does he work at Boeing or aircraft or for the government? Where does the man work? The police department? He said he didn't know where he worked. He didn't have any idea where he worked. He says, I've got it in a paper somewhere. I said, you don't know where he's employed? No, he didn't know where he was employed. He says, I'll just tell you the truth, he's only 21 of 20 cases that I have this week. So I don't have time to look that up. So I said, now look, you know, I'm sitting here in Carmel, and I have a list of questions I can ask you. And I said, the killing of Robert Crown is the most important thing in conspiratorial work, as far as I study, outside of the shooting of George Wallace in May. It's the most important murder that's taken place, along with Congressman Mills back in Maryland, that I'm collecting information on that. I don't have investigators out in the field, but I can put away a lot of articles and come to conclusions of what questions to ask. But I told him it was a very important murder, and I went into the reasons why it was an important murder. And he's one of 20. He said, well, the district attorney cleared it all, that it was no conspiracy, and everything is all right. I said, you know, jogging is a very unusual hour, and he agreed with me. And we had a somewhat friendly conversation. He agreed that jogging is a definite time, usually in the early morning, just like back east, Congressman Mills was at the barn at 7 in the morning when no one else was up when he was shot. 7 in the morning. So I said, I gave him a list of questions. I said, jogging, it gives him a set time before he goes home and showers and gets back to the assembly. And he said, but you know, if somebody wanted to kill him, they wouldn't run over him, they would shoot him. I said, you're an investigator and you're telling me that they wouldn't run into him, just go through a crosswalk and kill him? He said, no. And I said, did you ever see the movie Z? And he said, no. And I said, do you want me to tell you about 30 accidents where people were murdered in cars? And he said, really? I said, yes. I said, I can give you a lot of murders where people were run over in automobile accidents that had to do with conspiracy cases. And I gave him a personal one that occurred in my own family, and where I'm collecting the information where the car seats had been removed and the seats fell out of the car, and I'm working on my own family murder and the chain of command of how that came down. And I said, I put those things together, and I know how these cars accidents take place because I've experienced one. And I know from my research, I've kept files on these things. So he said, if I came up to Alameda, we could go into these questions. And I told him what kind of questions I wanted to ask. I didn't give him too many of them because he can doctor that up by the time we get together. And I want to get a few more surprise questions. So I listed about 20, and I'll go to Alameda and I'll look at his file. And if they don't let me see it, then they're covering a conspiracy. If they let me see it and don't have anything to hide, maybe I can give some leads and see for my own satisfaction. If the man's a, you know, 40, 50 year old optometrist who's had a shop in the same shopping center for a few years and 40 years and 3 years and hasn't changed homes or occupations, and he got, you know, anxious to get to work and ran over the man, that's one thing. But maybe his job is at the other end of the town. Maybe he doesn't pass that corner every morning. I want to know how often he passes that intersection. Is it a regular habit if he lived there all the time? And then we'll go over those things and we'll talk about it. And I told my experience with the LAPD after the Sirhan thing. And so if I get a chance, I'll go up to Alameda and check out the Robert Crown, because based upon my research, I still contend that it's very easy, that it was a plan to kill him. And it goes high up to the chain of command, like all the other conspiracies I've studied. Well, we're rolling along pretty fast. Last week I was racing along because I had so much to tell you. But there was something that came to my mind this week that may be of interest to you. It isn't Watergate, but it has to do with conspiracies. Because the Watergate, if you buy Newsweek and Time and Magazine and all the papers, we'll get back to it next week. But this has to do with a man in San Francisco who surfaced this week under the alias of Paul Maris. His actual name is Gerald Martin Zelmanowicz, and he was an informer against the mafia 3 years ago. And he came out to San Francisco and he latched on to Alvin Duskin. Now, Alvin Duskin, this is the way the Justice Department helps their friends out. Alvin Duskin was known in the Bay Area as an anti-war person. He had paid ads in the paper against the war. He was a liberal, bordering on radical, anti-Nixon, anti-administration, anti-high-rise, and he was very much for ecology up in the Bay Area. He was very social, and he got busy in his political life, and he had a big business. So 3 years ago, a man came forward as a volunteer worker against high-rise propositions in San Francisco, and his name was Maris. And after several years, he had swindled Alvin Duskin out of $200,000. So there was a lawsuit. And Harold Lips of the Investigator noticed that this particular Paul Maris had Social Security card of himself and his wife in consecutive numbers. And that began to ring as something very funny, and the investigation finally broke open that he is this mafia figure who was wanted for a large operation. He got immunity from arrest for pinning two other dealers, mafia people, down. And he'd been in California with a disguise. And the Justice Department had provided him with this cover story. They had given him a new name, family name, identification. And they admitted when the story broke that it was not unusual practice that 150 to 250 members of the mafia have been given government assistance and started new lives and received government protection. If they say 150 to 250, you know there's thousands more, but that's where they put the figure, that the Justice Department accommodates them. And the extortion plot of what he was involved in stolen properties and securities, has been revealed, and the front of Paul Maris was exposed. And it reminded me of consecutive orders and false identifications of, in the back of The Realist, I have that section on Jim Garrison and how he was framed and how the Justice Department set up false affidavits and aliases for a man to plant evidence against Jim Garrison to get him in a pinball operation because of his suit against Clay Shaw as being part of the conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. The Justice Department wanted to frame Garrison, so they gave Pershing Gervais a false name and a job in Canada where he went on spying for the company he worked for there before, and his chain of command went from Washington Justice Department to Detroit General Motors and then up to General Motors in Canada, where he received $18,000 for 1 year just to sit around and do nothing. Well, the consecutive numbers brought back the Kennedy research, which we haven't gone into for a while because of the Watergate material. And it brought to mind a case which I think it might be of interest to you because it ties, it makes a full cycle back to the Watergate. And it has to do with a particular man named Jacob Floyd who lived in Alice, Texas. And he was an attorney there. And his son was killed. His son's name was Buddy Floyd. And a lawyer got information about who killed his son, rather. A lawyer called in, his name was Sam Burris, the district attorney, called in Jacob Floyd and said, here's a man, Alfredo Cervantes, he and two others killed your son. And in the process of the investigation, they found out that a man named Osborne had hired the assassins to kill, they actually wanted to kill Jacob Floyd, but they killed his son, Buddy Floyd, by mistake. And then a man named Osborne had hired the assassins in Oaxaca, Mexico, who came up to Alice, Texas, and had shot the son by mistake instead of the father. And they mentioned the name Osborne. Well, 5 years later, the trial lawyer that worked on this particular case with Jacob Floyd, and remember the name Osborne, was reading, he's a friend of Penn Jones in Texas, and he's a trial lawyer, and they were reading the Warren Commission hearings, and they got to the documents that volume 25 and volume 24 were, that had to do with Oswald going to Mexico. And what they found was, and this gets to the consecutive numbers, because it was the consecutive numbers that pulled this thing in San Francisco this last week. They found that Oswald in New Orleans on September the 17th, 1963, stood in line with four other people, and got an application to go into Mexico City. And these people, two were in front of him and two were in back. His number to get into Mexico City was 24085. And the people before him were Sam North, number 24082, and Judith North, 24083. And Oswald was 24085, and then George DeMenn was 24087, and his wife Florence DeMenn was 24086. Well, these people applied in New Orleans to go into Mexico, and 1 week later, 9 days later, they all went into Mexico at the same time. Three of them went in at Laredo, Mexico, entered, and two of them went into Ciudad Alemán, which is 100 miles south, in addition to another man named Anthony Oswald. So the consecutive numbers made this trial lawyer, who years before, a year or two before, had worked on the case of the Jacob Floyd, suspicious about these five people entering Mexico the same day that Oswald entered Mexico and leaving the same time that Oswald entered Mexico. So they began to subpoena the bus fare and the bus tickets and the list of bus passengers that went with Lee Harvey Oswald into Mexico. And he was sitting next to a man named John Bowen. He was sitting, John H. Bowen, on the bus. Well, they traced John Bowen to be Albert Osborne, if you can follow that. And Osborne had hired the assassins for the Floyd case, the Jacob Floyd case. So the consecutive numbers that Oswald stood in line with in New Orleans to get an entry into Mexico were used 9 days later by the people in front of him and the people in back of him going into Mexico. And this man was interested in the consecutive numbers, but as he's reading the passenger list, he comes across the name Osborne, and he's checking everyone on the bus. And through a lot of investigation, Osborne turns out to be the Bowen on the bus that's sitting next to Oswald turns to be the Osborne who hired the same assassins for the Floyd case. And that opened up a whole chain of command in Mexico, and the document that I got from this trial lawyer did research and broke it into the conspiracy plans into the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now, last week, in my article, The Realist, I referred to the CIA as being responsible for altering of elections because it's better known and it's part of the DIA. It's over it. The National Security Council sits over all these agencies. But the secret papers that John Dean had that the government is hiding and Sam Ervin doesn't know whether to show us or not, the Gestapo plan, mentions the Defense Intelligence Agency. And Osborne worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency and the FBI. And there was a letter that Robert Kennedy received in, this is volume 26 of the Warren Commission hearings, page 417. He received it December the 31st, 1963, from Mexico, a man, Mexican by race and nationality, who said, "I, your servant, am willing to identify the people who killed your brother. I used to be a friend of Oswald and also of Albert," and that's Albert Osborne, who was Bowen, who sat on the bus with Oswald going down to Mexico. He said, "I knew the plan. I never thought it would turn out to be a true plan. I lost our friendship. I didn't accept to introduce communist propaganda into Mexico." As a cover, they were handing out communist propaganda. Well, the man who was sitting next to Oswald on the bus going to Mexico, Mr. Bowen, who turns out to be Osborne, had many trips to Jamaica. And the testimony in the document I had ties in his trips to Jamaica to John Connally on the island in Jamaica. And many times people ask me on radio shows and interviews about the president being airborne down to Coy Bay and down to Jamaica. And this is the area where the world headquarters of the former Nazis house themselves, and this is where Albert Osborne and Oswald were in Jamaica. They were in Jamaica, going back and forth from Mexico to Jamaica. Now, in the course of the research, the document that was put out by this trial lawyer, he mentioned money that was sent to the School of Assassins that was funded. Carl McIntyre was one of the men that was behind the funding of the money down to the School for Assassins, and Carl McIntyre's name comes out in the Watergate case because he was behind Charles Colson when he was put in the White House, and Charles Colson was the man who hired Howard Hunt. When Bernard Barker was on the stand last week, he talked about Carlos Prieto-Sicaras. That was the contact man that Bernard Barker has in Miami. And Carlos Prieto-Sicaras comes through this Torbett document on the framework of the past assassinations. The point I'm making is the Watergate people, like Howard Hunt relating to Colson and McIntyre, or Bernard Barker to Carlos Prieto-Sicaras, or Oswald and Osborne relating to John Connally and those islands in Jamaica. The Watergate is nothing but an extension of the Dallas conspiracies, and the Senate committee is investigating the campaign practices of 1972. But the trees in the forest that McCord talks about, the Gestapo they talk about, the fears of American secret police force, it didn't just start in 1970. This is the important thing to remember. President Nixon said, I started this secret group and J. Edgar Hoover didn't approve of it, so I disbanded it. I don't believe they disbanded it. I believe that the thing that J. Edgar Hoover didn't approve of, because he was in on the other past political assassinations, he didn't approve of the martial law plan that would cancel all elections and round up every radical in the country in a concentration camp thing. And I don't think he approved of the plan to eliminate Wallace as a contender in the last election. This week, if you notice, that John Dean is talking about the money of Herbert Kalbach that went into the Wallace campaign. Large amount of money, $200,000 to $400,000, went from Herbert Kalbach to defeat George Wallace. That was in the paper this week. Because, in quotes, the Republican strategist, as a political threat to Nixon, figured George Wallace was the biggest threat. So they put $200,000 to $400,000. Now, Donald Segretti has said that his groups had infiltrated the Wallace camp. So if the commission, the Senate, rather, doesn't want to go into Dallas right away, I think we should write letters and remind them that all of these links of Wallace, the case being wide open, remember Arthur Brammer, didn't get tried on a federal charge yet, and Congressman Hill, who died just last week, I don't have time on the program in 45 minutes a week to go into these things, but he seemed to be a conduit of funds. $25,000 from Marie Stand's safe went through his election campaign fund, and he doesn't know where it went. And yet there were policemen in Maryland that must have worked with the Wallace thing that cleaned up the mess afterwards, and Brammer's in the Maryland jail, and it must be a lot to pay off him, because in his diary he spoke of that secret $10 million that belongs to what Lewis Tackwood says, the martial law plan. So I think when we read the words Gestapo in the paper or the Nuremberg trials, the name of the show is Dialogue Conspiracy, and I do like to deal with the tentacles that have to do with the deaths of the particular witnesses. Next week I'll do some more about the airplane crash in Chicago. I talked with Sherman Skolnick for about an hour this week, but there just isn't enough time. We move along, and it looks like the time is up as it is. So next week we'll get together and try to cover some more in the 45 minutes, and keep well till next week.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy, featuring research.